This program is brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you like what you hear and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.
Good afternoon, this is Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM and www.resonancefm.com on the net. There's no other way of saying it. Today's programme consists of more spoken word items, some or one at least with musical accompaniment. Does that transgress the spoken word category? Well, never mind. As long as they remain firmly speaking and don't break into song or anything, what else could they do? Well, they could utter sounds, make noises with mouths, create reverberations before the vocal cords, chatter teeth, laugh, belch, groan, but not sing. Starting with Bob Cobbing and his poem called Worm. "Oh, that's the name of the song, is it?" Alice said, trying to feel interested. "No, you don't understand," the knight said, looking a little vexed. "That's what the name is called. The name really is The Aged, Aged Man." "Then I ought to have said, that's what the song is called," Alice corrected herself. "No, you oughtn't. That's quite another thing. The song is called Ways and Means." "But that's only what it's called, you know." "Well, what is the song then?" said Alice, who was by this time completely bewildered. "I was coming to that," the knight said. "The song really is A Sitting on a Gate, and the tune's my own invention." "But the tune isn't his own invention," she said to herself. "It's I give thee all I can no more." Where was I? Yes, Bob Cobbing's poem called Worm, from a newish book on the life and work of Bob Cobbing, entitled Book. That's Book with five O's. Which was the proposed name for a bookshop to be opened on Longacre, but nothing came of it after Better Books was closed by the Collins bookshop chain. But that's another story. Stick to the point. Read Steve Willie piece from Book. Okay, so I have this newish title with me, Book, The Life and Work of Bob Cobbing. And the piece in question is by someone called Steve Willie, Locating the 1950s, Bob Cobbing's Poems and Places. And dressed in bright green and red, with a long white beard, Bob Cobbing, in the year before he died, yelled his poem Worm to an audience of children and their parents who walk in and out of shot of a YouTube video. That shows a seated Cobbing reading inside the brightly lit domes of the York Colourscape. 13 years earlier, a 5-minute collaborative performance of Worm was included as the fifth track on the A-side of Bird Yak's LP Aberration, 1988. In 1966, Worm accompanied the visual typewriter poem Wow Rom Rom as one of the pages in the Writers' Forum publication Ayarun. It was 12 years prior to this that Cobbing first-hand wrote Meditation on Worms, a 55-word piece he considered to be his first verbal poem of any consequence. The recurrence of Worm not only marks changes in Cobbing's aesthetic commitments, but also registers changes in Cobbing's creative context. Cobbing takes Worm with him as he moves from working as a teacher, visual artist and local arts organiser in post-war suburban Hendon to participating in the development of concrete poetry as part of a 1960s international counterculture, then to lo-fi, post-punk, collaborative and genre-crossing performances in the pubs of Thatcher-era London. The changing appearances of Worm in these settings asks of itself, am I the same poem? And about Cobbing, it asks, is he the same man? To answer yes to both these questions is to understand adaption and endurance through mutability as key creative principles in Cobbing's poems across time. Knowing that Meditation on Worms was first written in 1954 is important in biographical and literary historical terms, providing a fixed point against which the lifelong duration of the poem can be measured and given meaning. When the world changed, Cobbing changed his poetry in response. Even when these changes were dramatic, the 1988 version of Worm, for example, runs for over 5 minutes and features fast, high-pitched, bird-like whistling, aggressive growling and insistent bowing. Each change is part of the poem's ongoing meaning. So anyway, that's from an essay by Steve Willey in a book, The Life and Work of Bob Cobbing. And we will now play Worm from 1988. This is from Bird Yak, or the LP is actually called Aberration. And let me see, the cast on Worm was Bob Cobbing on voice, Hugh Metcalf on guitar, live electronics, hi-hat, improvised bass drum, and Mar Lou Bangerter on violin. So this is the 1988 version of Worm.
Rust, moth, fungus, mildew, dry rot, canker, maggot,
thank you.
carcass, cadaver, carrion, dust, earth, ashes, mummy.
Responsible. There's nothing I can do. Nothing, nothing, nothing I can do. Helpless. I'm not responsible. It's not up to me. I can't help it. Can't help. Can't. Canada can't. Don't ask me. I don't know. I know nothing. No.
Please excuse my further delay in getting back to you. I've now listened to both the first priority tapes of your conversation with McFarlane's, which are interesting. I am afraid, however, that my editor feels the material is still a little inconclusive on tape-recorded phone calls, especially since we've no contemporary record of your informing people that they were being recorded. From our audience's point of view, the larger problem is the complexity of the tale, which comes down to so many different points of law or principle that we feel it would be unlikely that many listeners would be able to relate to the whole experience. I do hope that you understand our genuine interest in your case, but that having listened thoroughly to the material, we do not feel that we can proceed any further. I do hope that you eventually achieve success in your undertaking. Yours sincerely. And I believe the cassettes are with that letter as well.
Righto. Well, thank him for his kind efforts, and tell him I shall just have to try my luck elsewhere.
Okay.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Is that Mr. Paddy's?
Yes.
Oh, hello, it's Maurice Seddon. I just wondered whether you'd reached any conclusion one way or the other.
Well, I just looking at it, I'm talking to a guy who lives up the road here. He has a Grundig tape recorder, and he was talking about these wheels, you know, the spindles that carry the changes. Actually, Grundig gives you a spindle that comes with the machine, which either you use in the States or you use it here in the UK, depending on where you are. And so that just came to... That's what I had in mind with this Concord thing, that if you could get a spindle for it, then you don't need to go through all the rigmarole. You just change the spindle on it.
Well, yes, but the problem, of course, being that it's a very old machine. It's a machine I've never heard of. Have you ever heard of that make before or since?
Oh, yeah. Well, it's a big make in the States.
Really?
That was in the States when they weren't allowed to come in as Sony or Panasonic or any of those names. They had to come in under a U.S. supplier.
Is that how it's done?
It's actually, Concord is actually the Sony of Japan. No?
Yes.
Nowadays, of course, they don't bother with that, so the name has just died out. But the machine was made, was a very common machine back in the 60s, back in the States, as far as manufacturing goes. Concord is a big manufacturer.
Yes.
But it was an importer house more than a manufacturer. It just imported these things under that name.
Just a sort of convenience name.
Well, yeah, they weren't allowed. It was at that time they had a problem with the import restrictions. And they weren't allowed to import Japanese equipment into the States because the States wanted to build up their own industry, electronics, you know, RCA and all those. They objected. So what they did is they brought them in and then gave them a name like Concord in this case and said it was U.S. specifications and so forth, and, you know, just to avoid this. But now, of course, they've got agreements, and so it doesn't make any difference. They don't use it anymore. That's the reason you don't hear Concord, because the practice didn't cease to exist. But That's really the question is, I'm really not too keen on putting up 300 for it, to be honest with you, because I don't, you're going to use it that much, and I would rather invest 300 in something that I was going to have a real lot of use on, and with the new technology coming out, like compact disc and all these sort of things, that I would probably get more use out of it than I would just recording this on a tape. And the tapes I've got is the one I gave you. I got about 8 of those, which, you know, there's no great collection. I don't have a great collection of music, let's put it that way.
Yes.
So really what I was trying to do was to find out, you know, whether if you could junk something and get a spindle on there to go on there, it wouldn't cost that much. But if you got to build something, yeah, I can understand it's going to take a bit of time.
But look, I think the logical way of dealing with this thing is if you would be kind enough to give me the maximum figure you're prepared to go to, I will do my very best to accommodate you and to work within that figure. You see, normally, what I would do, everything that I touch normally doesn't merely get dealt with in its essentials, but it also gets very thoroughly checked through to make sure that not only anything that may have gone wrong in it is put right, but also that anything that looks as though it's likely to go wrong in the near future is also put right, so that I can then, as a matter of course, give it a one-year guarantee. Now, a guarantee obviously costs money to give, because it may be implemented, and if it is implemented, it costs money to carry out the guarantee work. So, therefore, I quote you a figure of 300, which would include a guarantee, which would include checking the machine over and making it really work properly and make sure it's going to stay working properly. And if done like that, it'll probably go for very many years without further trouble and is in any case guaranteed for a year. But if you don't want the guarantee for a year, and if you don't want anything done to it except the bare essentials, well then, give me your top price, and I will probably be able to work, I hope, depending what the figure is. I hope I can work within that figure.
Yeah, well, you think it's got any resale value?
Well, I don't, for the very good reason, at the moment it has no resale value, because it won't work on the European norm. I mean, if once it's converted to the European norm, then certainly it may have a resale value. It's difficult to say what that resale value is, because, you see, I don't have a shop. I never have done. I'm purely an engineer, and I'm purely concerned with repairs, technical modifications, and I do solely those things which are too obscure, too difficult, too foreign, too old for other people to deal with them. This is my raison d'être, and therefore I don't involve myself in buying and selling unless I absolutely have to. All I can tell you is that the replacement value, you see, as you surely know, all serious recording to this day is never, ever done on cassette, never, 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 under any circumstances. It is always done on reel-to-reel. And the cheapest reel-to-reel 12 months ago was £1,850, and it had only headphone playback.
Yeah.
So that's all I can quote you in terms of replacement figures, which is valid, say, from the point of view of insurance, if you lose it, or it gets burned in a fire, or stolen, or whatever. Mm. Now, I never find myself involved, or very, very rarely, in selling anything, because the people who come to me bring their things mostly because they've had them for decades. There is a sentimental attachment, as there is in your case. They want the thing made to work, and there is no other solution than that of repairing the old equipment, which will fulfill their requirement. So all I know is what I normally charge, and £300 is a perfectly normal figure that I charge every day for reel-to-reel machines. And people are perfectly willing to pay that because they then get their machine back in going order with the probability that they can use it for many years. But as to the resale value, you see, there are two ways of viewing this old equipment. If you view it from the point of view of the hoi polloi, the herd in the street, they would look at any of this old equipment, yours or mine or any of my clients, and they say, what, that old rubbish? Where is the nearest skip? Throw it away. It's only if you look in a circle of a small, exclusive group of connoisseurs, of dilettantes, of professional musicians, of recording studio people, of people who have owned equipment like this for decades, as you have, and who know how good it is. For these people, this kind of equipment is beyond price valuable, simply because we live in a trash age, and never again will things of that solidity and durability, as far as we can foresee, be made. And if they are made, they will be at astronomic prices, in view of the great increase in production costs and labour fees.
Yeah, well, the only thing is, I guess, it really boils down to is that the amount of use I'd get out of it. For $300, I could put it into a compact disc, and which I don't have, and stick it on top of my present stereo, and I would get more out of that than I would out of this machine. Which this is my problem, because I would just stick it back up in the attic, and one day if I ever went back to the States, which is to say all is possible, I'd just take it with me. But because there's nothing wrong with the machine, I don't think. Heck, it's, you saw it's in pretty good condition.
Well, you seem to have looked after it, certainly.
And, you know, I had it way up in the attic, so it's very dry. It's not down in the basement or anything. So it's kept, I think, in pretty good shape. So I'm not worried about it having to be, you know, reworked or anything. Plus, I haven't used it hardly.
Well, apropos not using it, if I may come back on that point. I'm not saying specifically in the case of your machine, but in my general experience with the vast majority of machines that have not been used, a great many of them go wrong, and sometimes disastrously wrong, purely as a result of not being used.
That's possible, no question about it. I agree that use is a good thing, like with cars or anything else.
I mean, I'm constantly getting machines in here which people haven't used for 10, 15, 20 years. They try to use them, and they immediately go wrong, or they go wrong within a very short time. And they're then greatly distressed and find that they can't get the thing mended or whatever, and I then get involved with them.
The thing is, I'm just wondering whether I just shouldn't just come by and pick the thing up, forget about it, and close it down, because...
Well, I would quite differently suggest. I mean, apart from the years, I've taken an interest in the thing. It's an interesting project. I've spent some time looking at it, which I wouldn't dream of charging you for, but which nevertheless is wasted time if we don't do something with it. I would suggest that one goes ahead on whatever basis you are prepared to spend on, and I will do my best. If I find I can't do it within the limit you say, I'll say I'm sorry, I can't. If I can, I'll go ahead and do it.
Yeah, well, the thing is, what I was saying, I'd rather, if I'm going to put out any kind of money, I would just put it out towards getting something that I would use pretty consistently, and that's something that I would that we use with our present stereo. This unit has to hook into, you got to have tapes. You got to start up with tape collections and that sort of thing. Well, anyway, that's my comment on it. I don't know. I just felt that the spindle you could probably pick up for £100 or something like that and stick it in. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work, and you forget about it. But I didn't realize you're going to have to build something like that.
Are you saying you're prepared to spend £100 and no more? Is that right?
Yeah.
I will see what I can do. Leave it with me. I will see what I can do. I'll come back to you in a day or two.
You're going to look at it?
I'll see what I can do.
Okay.
Now, apropos the other thing, no, I haven't got time to tell you about that. Now, I've got to go. I'm late for an appointment. Will you be in late this evening?
Yep.
I may give you a ring then. Will you be in tomorrow morning?
Possibly, but I don't know. That's a bit variable in the morning. But anyway...
I'll try and ring you late this evening, because I've got news of the other thing. Can't stop and talk now. Bye-bye till later.
Too far. We don't go too far. None of us will go too far. Maybe sometimes we went too far, but now we won't, because we're real nice guys, decent fellows, kind gentlemen, considerate friends, non-vengeful associates, reliable partners. We don't make trouble, we like everything nice. We don't go too far, yeah. We'll go too far. Little,
I'm going to read aloud from the work of some modern British poets, and also read a few poems of my own. My own ones include some early ones, some fairly hurly-burly ones, very recent ones, reasoned decent ones, lamenting ones, and lamentable ones, together with a few comments whenever they may or may not be necessary. I wondered what kind of words I should put down to introduce these laboriously churning poems of mine. Indeed, I thought they want from me no introduction at all. Let them stand on their own feet, the little lyrical cripples. But I felt, too, that there must be a few words of a kind before or between the ranting of the poems. A whole hour of loud and unrelieved verse-speaking is, I imagine, hell to anyone except some brash, antiseptic, 42-toothed, smilingly ardent young hunters of culture with net, notebook, poison bottle, pin and label. Or to the dowager hunters of small, seedy lions stalking the metropolitan bush with legs and rifles cocked. Or to the infernal, androgynous literary ladies with three names who produce a kind of verbal ectoplasm to order as a waiter dishes up spaghetti. But to an ordinary audience, not that there's any such thing, but only, like yourselves, bunches of eccentrics, there must be a hush between poems. And how was I going to fill that hush with harmless words until the next poem came woodenly booming along like a carved bee? I couldn't, I knew, say much, if anything, about what the poems might mean. In a few cases, of course, I didn't anyway know myself. Though that is true, I hope, only of certain of my earliest published poems, explosive bloodbursts of a boily boy in love with the shape and sound of words, death, unknown love, and the shadows on his pillow. And for the rest of the poems, they are what they mean, however obscure, unsuccessful, sentimental, pretentious, ludicrous, rhetorical, wretched, ecstatic, plain bad. Or could I shove in autobiographical snippets saying where I lived and how, when I wrote this or that, indicating how I felt in heart and head at that particular time? I could, for instance, talk about my education, which critics say I have not got. And that's true enough, but I do wish I had learned some other languages apart from English, BBC, Third Programme, and Saloon. Then perhaps I could understand what some people mean when they say I have been influenced by Rambo. My education was the liberty I had to read whatever I cared to. I read indiscriminately and all the time with my eyes hanging out. I never could have dreamt there were such goings-on, such do's and argy-bargies, such ice blasts of words, such love and sense and terror and humbug, such and so many blinding bright lights breaking across the just awaking wits and splashing all over the pages as they can never quite do again after the first revelation, in a million bits and pieces, all of which were words, 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 and each of which seemed alive forever in its own delight and glory and right. It was then in my father's brown study before homework, usually the first botched scribblings of gauche and gawky, heart-choked poems about black-bloomered nymphs, the jussive grave, and the tall, improbable loves of the sardine-packed sky, poems never to be shown to anyone except on pain of death, that I began to know one kind of writing from another, one kind of badness, one kind of goodness. I wrote endless imitations, though I never, at the time of writing, thought them to be imitations, but rather colossally original, things unheard of, like eggs laid by tigers. Imitations of whatever I happened to be galloping then, Thomas Brown, Robert W. Service, Stevenson, De Quincey, Eskimo Nell, Newbolt, Blake, Marlowe, the Imagists, the Boy's Own Paper, Keats, Poe, Burns, Dostoevsky, Anon, and Shakespeare. I tried my little trotters at every poetical form. How could I know the tricks of this trade unless I tried to do them myself, for the poets wouldn't soar from the grave and show me how their poems were done by mirrors, and I couldn't trust the critics then, or now. I learnt that the bad tricks come easy, and the good tricks, which help you to say what you think you wish to say in the most meaningful, moving way. Naturally, I'm still learning, though in earnest company, I must call these tricks by other technical names. Nothing in those days was too much for me to try. If Paradise Lost had not already been written, I would have had a shot at it. My early days, dear God. I never thought that one day I might be here or anywhere filling up time before, I'm afraid, a drone of poems by talking about my early days just as though I were a man of letters. I used to think that once a writer became a man of letters, if only for 10 minutes, he was done for. But I feel all right. I suppose I am suffering from one of the first pleasant injections of insidious corruption. My early days seems to me to suggest that I am responsible and established, that all the old doubts and worries are over. Now I need bother my head about nothing except birth, death, sex, money, politics, and religion. That jowled and wigged, aloof and branded as a bloodhound, sober as a judge in my bit of vermin, I can summon my juvenile literary delinquents before me and give it a long periodic sentence. For me to think of prefacing my poems by talking about my early days is to invite myself to indulge myself with 100 tongue-picked, chopped and chiseled evocative shock phrases in a flamboyant rememoration of past and almost entirely fictitious peccadilloes of interest to nobody but me and my guardian angel, who was, I believe, an unsuccessful psychoanalyst in this life, and who's lolloping above me now, casebook in claw, a little seedy and down at winged heel in the guttural consulting rooms of space. I'm the kind of human dredger that digs up the wordy mud of his own dead sea, the kind of pig that roots for unconsidered truffles in the reeky wood of his past. Still, I gladly accept the fact that I first saw the light and screamed at it in a loud lump of Wales. I'm only human, as the man says, who deep inside him refuses to believe it. And of course, my writing would not be what it is, always experimental and always completely unsatisfactory, if it had not been for the immortal fry of the town in which I simmered up. Naturally, my early poems and stories, two sides of an unresolved argument, came out of a person who came willy-nilly out of one particular atmosphere and environment, and are part and parcel, park and castle, lark and seashell, dark and school bell, muck and entrail, cock, rock and bubble, accent and sea lap, root and rhythm of them. And that, so far as I am concerned, is all there is to it. If I had been born and brought up in an igloo and lived on Wales, not in it, about the same would be true. Except that then it would have been extremely unlikely had I become a writer, and goody, crime I justified detractors. Or I could preface this small reading by talking about poets. I think they're pretty dull. It's a common failing to underestimate the sheer ordinariness of the lives and characters of many dead poets, and to overestimate that of living poets whom one might come across. Indeed, it is not unusual for people, after they have met a more or less living poet, to wonder with hardly concealed amazement how he could ever have produced the work he has. I accept certain oldish poets alive today who are made solemn and unapproachable not so much by their poetry or their strict religious observance as by their judicial positions on the boards of eminent publishers, who may even then, at one's time of meeting, be considering one's own first experimental novel of innocence lost and wisdom catastrophically gained by the age of 19. The same kind of amazement, the idol destroyed. How could such a man have written such marvelous devotional poetry? I saw him fall downstairs yesterday in his suspenders. Might well have occurred to us had we met many of the poets now dead. I think it was Logan Pearsall Smith who remembered how, as a small boy, he saw, of all people, Matthew Arnold in a restaurant, and Matthew Arnold talked and laughed much too loud. I couldn't talk about poets, but I do wish that I was reading only the work of other modern poets now, and not my own at all. That is, I wish I were reading the work of modern poets I like, for I like to read only the poets I like. This means, of course, that I have to read a lot of poems I don't like before I find the ones I do, But when I do find the ones I do, then all I can say is here they are, and read them aloud to myself or to anyone like yourselves, voluntarily cornered. And when I read aloud the poems of modern poets I like very much, I try to make them alive from inside. I try to get across what I feel, however wrongly, to be the original impetus of the poem. I'm a practicing interpreter, however much of a flannel-tongued one-night stander. But in my own poems, I've had my say, and when I read them aloud, I can only repeat it. When I read, for instance, my earliest poems aloud, my interpretation of them, though that's far too weighty a word just for reading them aloud, can't be considered as the final or original interpretation, performance, or blare. I do not remember now the first impulse that pumped and drove those lines along, and that which is in them is for you more than for me, for you or for anyone, or of course for no one, to make what you or he will of them. In these poems I've had my say, now I'm only saying it again. But what does it matter? Poetry is what in a poem makes you laugh, cry, prickle, be silent, makes your toenails twinkle, makes you want to do this or that or nothing, makes you know that you are alone and not alone in the unknown world, that your bliss and suffering is forever shared and forever all your own. All that matters about poetry is the enjoyment of it, however tragic it may be. All that matters is the eternal movement behind it, the great undercurrent of human grief, folly, pretension, exaltation, and ignorance, however unlofty the intention of the poem. And I'm going to read some poems straight, without hindrance, for this isn't a lecture at all. It isn't about trends and impacts and the influence of someone on someone else. It isn't trying to prove anything by quotations, to groove one hypothetical school of poetry oilily into another, to jigsaw all the pieces which are poems into one improbable picture and then say, here it is. This is modern poetry. I'm no grey and tepid don smelling of water biscuits. Only posterity can see the picture of the poetry of today as a whole, and the function of posterity is to look after itself. You can tear a poem apart to see what makes it technically tick, and say to yourself when the works are laid out before you, the vowels, the consonants, the rhymes and rhythms, yes, this is it. This is why the poem moves me so. It is because of the craftsmanship. But you're back again where you began. The best craftsmanship always leaves holes and gaps in the works of the poem so that something that is not in the poem can creep, crawl, flash or thunder in. Everything, Yeats said, though he was talking of the highest moments of the most exalted art, everything happens in a blaze of light. Only the printed page or the interior monologue or the private discussion can give to each separate poem the full concentrated time that the poem is justified in asking for the assessment of its success or failure to demonstrate its own hypothesis. In public, all I think that can be presented is the poem itself, and all that can be experienced in public is the realization of the immediacy or lack of immediacy through which the hypothesis, the central motive of the poem, affects the reader through his ear. The printed page is the place in which to examine the works of a poem, and the platform the place on which to give the poem the works. You won't ask me any questions afterwards, will you? I don't mind answering a bit, only I can't. Even to such simple questions as what is the relationship of the poet to society in a heterogeneous age, I can only cough and stammer. And some of the questions I remember from the nightmare past. Tell me, are the young English intellectuals really psychological? Is it absolutely essential, do you think, to be homosexual, to write love poems to women? I always carry Kierkegaard in my pocket. What do you carry? Thank you.
To begin at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town, starless and Bible black. The cobble streets silent and the hunched quarters and rabbits wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow black, fishing boat bobbing the sea. The houses are blind as moles, for moles see fine tonight in the snouting velvet dingles, or blind as Captain Cat, there in the muffled middle by the pump and the town clock, the shops in mourning, the welfare hall in widow's weeds, and all the people of the lulled and dumbfound town are sleeping now. Hush, the babies are sleeping. The farmers, the fishers, the tradesmen and pensioners, cobbler, schoolteacher, postman and publican, the undertaker and the fancy woman, drunkard, dressmaker, preacher, policeman, the web-foot cocker women and the tidy wives. Young girls lie bedded soft or glide in their dreams with rings and trousseau, brides mated by glowworms down the aisles of the organ-playing wood. The boys are dreaming wicked, or of the bucking ranches of the night on the Jolly Rogered Sea, and the anthracite statues of the horses sleep in the fields, and the cows in the byres, and the dogs in the wet-nosed yards, and the cats nap in the slant corners, or lope sly, streaking and needling on the one cloud of the mountain. You can hear the dew falling, and the hushed town breathing. Only your eyes are unclosed to see the black unfolded town fast and slow asleep. And you alone can hear the invisible starfall, the darkest before dawn minutely dew-gray stir of the black dab-filled sea where the Arethusa, the Curlew, and the Skylark, Zanzibar, Rhiannon, the Rover, the Cormorant, and the Star of Wales tilt and rise. Listen, it is night moving in the streets, the processional salt slow musical wind in Coronation Street and Cockle Row. It is the grass growing on Llareggyd Hill, dewfall, starfall, the sleep of birds in Milkwood. Listen, it is night in the chill squat chapel, hemming in bonnet and brooch and bombazine black, butterfly choker and bootlace bow, coughing like nanny goats, sucking mintos, 40 winking hallelujah. Night in the foray, quiet as a domino, in Ockie Milkman's lofts like a mouse with gloves, in Dye Bread's bakery, flying like black flour. It is tonight in Donkey Street, trotting silent with seaweed on its hooves, along the cockled cobbles, past curtain, fern pot, text and trinket, harmonium, holy dresser, watercolours done by hand, china dog and rosy tin tea caddy. It is night, neddying among the snuggeries of babies. Look, it is night, dumbly, royally winding through the coronation cherry trees, going through the graveyard of Bethesda with winds gloved and folded and dew-doffed, tumbling by the sailors' arms. Time passes. Listen. Time passes.
May it's Don it's may it's. 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 Don it's may. East eight is come. Pound dead moose. T-B-S-S. East eight is come. Pound dead moose. T-B-S-S. East eight is come. Pound dead moose. T-B-S-S. T-B-S-S. May. East eight is come. Pound dead moose. Don. T-B-S-S. May. East eight is come. Pound dead moose. Don. T-B-S-S. May. East eight is come. Pound dead moose. Don. T-B-S-S. May. It's. East eight is come. Pound dead moose. Don T-B-S-S. May. It's. Pound dead moose. Don it's. May. East eight is come. Pound dead moose. Don T-B-S-S. May. It's. Don East eight is come. Pound dead moose. It be assess. Don it's. May. It's. Don it's. May. It's. Don it's. May. Pound dead moose. T be assess.
Thank you. face was flushed and timid. He stared at the captain through frightened eyes. The captain reached for something to hold on to.
"Help me,"
he whispered as he rose slowly to his feet. The boy's face went pale. He recognized the sound. Silently, he pulled down the shade against the shadow. Lost in the doorstep of the empty house. "I'm trying to find my way home. I'm sorry. I miss you."
Jednak někdo by řekl, že je to rak, že je to krtím, je jaký by se mušle, je to tvar otský, temnému vlášť, šápky neznám, levé část, náplocha, je několik ba, to kolečno velí větší, nepruhované, nošedí, dále jlkem, plíce, je má, drveno zeletí, jalo se vždy od, no, zcela jsou potom modré, no, je, a posledně, když jsme ob této ost, do chvilchný řel, Pišně od naru kého a krého na se výkova obnáno deví a maky bejmi prosíc stro to strožer celý a tvrdem to mě znelným a já dojím pravdu na fanho.
Den enda verkliga vokalsonetten läst av Arthur Rimbaud.
A Oh,
This program has been brought to you by Resonance 104.4 FM. If you liked what you heard and want to support our work, please make a donation at fundraiser.resonance.fm.